Blog Talk Radio.
Our roots began in Africa, where we enjoyed self-determination and freedom, which were rooted in our sovereignty. Peace, family. Welcome to Dare to Win, the Us Lifting Us weekly radio program that airs every Thursday evening from 9 p.m. to 10 p.m. Eastern Time. Dare to Win is the place where we have sobering conversation about the economic plight of Black people and the imperatives that we build the global economic machinery that will free us and once again put us on the path of making history. We at Us Lifting Us have developed an exact methodology on how to build this global machinery and pass it forward to our children and future generations. To join tonight's conversation, please call 929-477-2789. Press the 1 on your phone when you want to make a comment or ask a question. If you prefer to listen on your computer, go to www.us, scroll down to the bottom of the homepage, click on the Dare to Win button, then click on Listen Live. You will be on the Blog Talk Radio site at that time. If you want to get reminders from Blog Talk Radio for upcoming Dare to Win programs, click on the Follow button. Ulu members, we have our own social media community. Please join if you have not already done so. There is a Dare to Win group, and we would like to have your feedback on past Dare to Win programs as well as topic suggestions for future programs. Tonight, we are discussing creating intergenerational wealth. I am Sister Q, and joining me for this evening's discussion are two ULU members, Brother Ongti and Brother L.A. Dixon. Peace, Brother Ongti. How are you doing tonight?
Greetings, Sister Q. I am well and glad to be here.
We're glad to have you here. Peace, Brother L.A. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, very well. Thank you for asking.
Thank you for joining us tonight. Brother Ongti, will you please do the honor to introduce Brother L.A. to the ULU family?
Most certainly, Sister Q, and it's my privilege to do so. But before I introduce Brother L.A. Dixon, I just want to give the family a little background on how this conversation came about.
Okay.
As you mentioned, both Brother L.A. and myself serve on the membership committee of Us Lifting Us, and we were in a subcommittee meeting around the planning for our annual meeting March 10th, 11th, and 12th of 2023. So, family, mark your calendars that the ULU Annual Members Meeting and Convention will be held virtually on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, March 10th, 11th, and 12th of 2023. So we're having this meeting, and in the process of figuring out some of the program aspects, Brother Dixon begins to share that he and his family put together a really dynamic and exciting program that enabled them to generate intergenerational wealth. And what really struck me was that it's so practical that just about anybody can do it. So let me tell you a little bit about Brother L.A. Just a second here. Here we go. He served as an independent coordinator consultant with the Agency for Persons with Disabilities. He served there for 6 years on the Executive Council with AARP, that's the American Association of Retired Persons Florida, and presently serves as a lead volunteer in Jacksonville. In addition, represented AARP on two boards, Florida Association of Aging Services Providers and Florida Council on Suicide Prevention. He retired from the city of Jacksonville in 2006 after 28 years serving as program manager of community and senior center services. As program manager, he was responsible for the daily activities of 19 senior citizens centers and was instrumental in achieving national accreditation at the Mary L. Singleton and Lane Wiley Senior Citizens. It goes on to say even more. I just want to give you the sense that he has served our community for three decades in a program administrator capacity and developing these programs so that they were robust and serving the needs of our people. So he has a servant heart, a servant spirit, and he comes to ULU with that same energy. And so I'm just going to ask Brother L.A. at this point to tell us a little bit about where he's from, who his folks are, and then give us the backdrop of how he and his family came to put together this program that, A, generated wealth, and that it was such in a way that it allowed them to pass it on to their children. So, Brother L.A., welcome to Dare to Win, and please share with our audience this very dynamic and exciting program that you and your family developed for building intergenerational wealth.
Thank you very much, Brother Ongti. The one thing I want to emphasize as we get started, I am a licensed insurance agent for the state of Florida. I just actually reached back and got those licenses about 6 months ago. it was a part of my life previously. But as I talk about how all this came about, you'll see why that's a part, an intricate part of the things that I do in the way I think in terms of intergenerational wealth. I'm not a financial advisor. However, based on the receipts that we have, I can validate that the things that we're going to discuss in terms of the strategy that me and my wife use, and I have to give her a lot of credit because she's a very dynamic person who is an intricate part of all of this that took place. The receipts are there, and generational wealth is possible for those who have not as much as maybe others. I want to share as we get started and as I talk that combined income of me and my wife during our working years was less than six figures. My wife never made over $40,000 a year working for the state of Florida. However, there are some practices that we put in place and some disciplines that we had allowed us to create well over $1 million worth of real estate assets based on information that I'll share with you tonight.
You created how much, Brother L.A.?
Oh, it's well over $1 million, probably $1.5 million. And
okay, well,
we did,
you certainly have my attention at this point.
Listen, and we did that, wow, it is mind-boggling. We did that with probably less than $80,000, okay? And the way we went about it, I'm sure most of you remember in 2007, around 2007, 2008, when the housing market went belly up and folks had overextended themselves in terms of the properties that they owned. They had mortgages they couldn't pay. Some folks, because the houses were appraised more than what they were worth, they took out additional income so that they can actually afford luxury items, such as buying luxury cars and things of that nature. They just went, hey, wow. Well, at one point it came to a point where they got over the head and they start turning the keys to these houses back to the lenders, and therefore it presented a crisis for a lot of folks. There were more houses on the market than there were people who could afford to buy them at the time. So what ended up happening is a lot of major venture capital folks came in and started buying up the houses. And they were buying them up in blocks, 50 to 100 houses at a time. Well, me and my wife always wanted to invest in houses, so we decided to try to get involved as well. We had some savings, because one thing my wife always believed since the age of 14, she never made a paycheck that she didn't save a dime or a dollar out of. So there are some resources there in savings. But that wasn't just the key. The key was the fact that we were competing against large corporate structures that had come into Florida and other places throughout the country, and they were buying up houses in blocks. In fact, the subdivision that we were staying in, when the last phase of houses they built ended up being bought, the entire subdivision, the last street, the entire 20 or 30 houses on that street was bought by a venture capital company out of California. So what we end up doing actually is working around them, and I say we were gathering the crumbs in terms of the real estate market. In other words, what they didn't want, we were able to acquire. These houses were all in subdivision. There was no house that we acquired that was less than I think the smallest one was probably 1,000 square feet. Others were probably more closer to 1,500 to 1,600 square feet. And the one we paid the lease for was $10,000. And right now the house is worth probably north of $160,000 to $170,000.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. When we bought that house, we probably put another $15,000 to $20,000 in it to bring it up to, you know, the specs that was needed for us to actually be able to rent it. But we did that with five or six houses. And like I said, that was the least of them in terms of the amount of money we put in based on the actual value of the house. And so in doing so, like I said, we start accumulating the houses, and the way we went about getting the resources and the funds for that is, yes, we took some money out of savings, but more than half that money came through the life insurance industry. Now, I say that the beginning of generational wealth for especially black folks was home ownership. But then after experiencing what we experienced and things falling in place the way they did, and when we needed the money to purchase these houses, they came through whole life insurance policies. We had whole life insurance policies not only on ourselves, but on our children's as well.
How many children do you have, Brother L.A.?
We have four. And in fact, we have a Brady Bunch. She had two and I had. Okay. I had two boys and she had a boy and a girl. And they're all grown now. But when they were children, and hers being younger, she took life insurance out on them. And when we got together and I understood why she was doing what she did, I took life insurance out on my two boys as well. Well, it's always been a stigma, especially with black folks, is that, oh, you don't put, you know, why would you take life insurance off of your kids? You're trying to profit off, you know, them dying or something of that nature. But that is not the case at all. The fact of the matter is, once you put whole life insurance in place, you can keep that for their entire life. Once you purchase the whole life, as they become adults, you can transfer that policy over to them. Well, there was a substantial amount of cash that had been built up in those policies. And so what we did, we borrowed our own money, which was a portion of the cash value in all those policies, and we bought these houses. And like I said, we paid anywhere from the cheapest $10,000 for one, the most we paid is $25,000 for our house. But all the houses, like I said, now is well worth more than $150,000, $160,000, and possibly some more than $200,000. And we did have to put a certain amount of money into the houses, but it was minimal because the work that we had done on the house, if we couldn't do it ourselves, we found individuals who could do the work for us at a reasonable price. Any questions at this point, Brother Auntie, that need to be clarified on my part?
Okay. No, I just want to kind of recap. So to begin with, prior to 2007, various lending groups were offering large loans to black folks and other groups
The bank.
For houses
the bank
that they really couldn't afford, the banks. And what they had done was they enticed them into these homes with what they called variable rate mortgages. So, you know, for the first year, the mortgage might be $1,100, $1,200 a month, but then after the second year, the mortgage might balloon up to $2,000 or $2,500. And when the mortgages started ballooning, people who were in these homes couldn't afford them, and the houses went back to the lenders, and that created a whole cascading event of foreclosures. And so many of us saw neighborhoods go from where people were buying the homes to where people were renting the homes. But that was a major crisis, the housing crisis that swept across the country. So that was the first thing. The housing market went belly up, as you say, and houses that had been sold, prices were inflated. Houses that had been selling for $400,000 dropped to as low as $200,000, in some cases even under $200,000. So it was a large, these were big houses, medium-sized houses, but now they were selling for pennies on a dollar. Now, if I heard you correctly, you, your wife, because of her saving practices and her discipline around that, she had saved money, and at the same time, you all had whole life insurance policies on your children, on your young children. And one thing that, so one question that emerged for me, Brother L.A., was what was the face value on those policies on your children?
The face value was $50,000, and on a couple of policies that you had was $100,000.
Okay. All right.
It was quite affordable because of the fact that
they were young.
Because
they're young, their ages are young, these policies are relatively inexpensive, is what you're telling us.
Yeah.
Okay.
Absolutely.
And then over time, the cash values in those policies had grown to a point where that money, coupled with the money that you all had in your savings, gave you the capacity to begin to purchase these homes that were now distressed. And selling for pennies on a dollar. Is that the way it unfolded for you?
Yeah, absolutely. That's absolutely correct. And like I said, we'd never put a mortgage on a home and didn't borrow against the house that we already had, you know, to accomplish that. And like I said, my wife never made over $40,000 a year, and combined we made less than $100,000 a year. You know, before all this took place, okay?
Right.
And
which I think is a key point, because there are a lot of families that you would think to be able to buy those houses, each person had to be making at least $100,000 a year, and you're saying your wife never made more than 40, and
yeah.
Together you all were little over $100,000. But what made the difference was the savings that you had, and then you could use the cash values that had built up in the life insurance policies that you had on your young children.
Right, and the beautiful part about that is the life insurance policies still exist. It's just that, you know, we took cash out of those policies that ultimately would come to us anyway. So unfortunately, in some untimely tragedy, or we lost a child and we had to use that policy, the difference of that policy still remained there today. And it's up to us whether we decide to put the money back in.
All right. Okay. All right. So now you've acquired these properties at pennies on a dollar. They've grown in value over the years. And now combined, you're looking at about $1.4 million or so in terms of.
Yeah, we have actually six properties, including the home that we, you know, presently live with, you know. But the properties are well over a million, and I mean close to probably 1.5, you know, in terms of the value of those properties.
You had said that you had grown up, like many of us, with the understanding, it was almost like a mantra in our community, that home ownership is the beginning of building intergenerational wealth. But if I heard you correctly, you were saying that before home ownership, it was the fact that you had those life insurance policies that enabled you to make this move. Is that what you said?
Yes, sir. That's absolutely correct. That's exactly what I said. Why, at this point, as I re-enter back into the insurance industry, when I talk to families, my position is that I have to be able to convince and get them to see the value in taking out these policies as early as possible. I mean, 6 to 12 months, you can get policies written. And those policies will stay with that child for the rest of their lives. Because, as you know, we've talked before, as you get older, health changes, difficult to even qualify for policies. And sometimes it's almost impossible to do so, you know. So it just makes sense to do it on the front end and do it as a benefit, not so much as to yourself, but as to your children as well.
So you accomplish two things by doing that. One, you protect the life of your children. I mean, you put enough financial resources around your children that in the event tragedy should strike, you have the money necessary to bury them, you know, just to call it like it is. But at the same time, and I think this is the genius of what your family did, you were using the life insurance policy as a financial instrument and resource to buy the house or to buy these houses.
Right. To take advantage.
So in other words, you weren't just sold on the life insurance policy. You were looking at the life insurance policy as a financial tool that your family could use to leverage and build wealth.
Yes. And like I say, now, you know, from the very beginning, we did not realize the housing market was going to take the turn that it took. But once it did, we realized what resources we had to be able to purchase these homes and to put a trust in place where if anything happened to me and my wife, the very least, every child would have at least one home, you know, for them to have for themselves and two others to decide how they want to deal with disposing of those. And the other part of it is I have two granddaughters. Now, if anything were to happen to any of those, any of the kids at any time in their lives, that transfer of home ownership will go to my granddaughters, which are 6 and 10 years old right now.
Hmm.
And I don't know whether it's fortunate or unfortunate, but I have four children, but only one, my son, have two kids. No one else have any. So It has to be a plan in place to pass down the wealth of what we've done. And that's the strategy that we have put in place, and everybody's on board with that. And, you know, I know a lot of people, they purchase, they get these properties and they flip them to make, you know, I guess, you know, a reasonable amount of money and carry on. But we decided that we would maintain these properties because what they provide is income for me and my wife right now during this period of our retirement. And
so
that's what
you turn those houses into rental properties. Is that what you're saying?
Oh, yeah. That's what they are right now. They are rental properties right now. And the other part of that is they're not just rental properties. They are income-producing properties, you know, for me and my wife. Like I said, we're both retired at this particular time. So that's over and above pensions that we had in place, over and above what little Social Security that is offered up, you know, it makes a substantial difference. And then the other thing I mentioned as we were talking is our strategy as a landlord is to provide these properties much less than a person would normally pay for a property of the size that we are offering the individuals to reside in. And the reason for that is because, you know, every time a tenant moves out of properties, it's going to cost you probably somewhere between $2,000-$3,000 or more. It just depends on what the damage assessments are and what it's going to take to get that property back to where it's rentable again. And so, therefore, we very seldom have anybody to leave as a tenant, because we purposely put them in a position where it'd be very difficult for them to go somewhere and get what we're offering for the cost, and therefore they remain there, and therefore it cuts down on our cost in terms of having to do the renovations or whatever it's going to take to bring the property back up to specs for the next person.
Wow. So now, here's what I heard you say. You have these properties, and when you rent them at a price lower than
market.
The market. In other words, if everybody is – well, just tell us, for example, one of those properties, what does it rent for?
Right now, we have one property that the market says, you know, $1,700 a month, okay?
Okay.
And we're renting the property for about $1,300.
Wow. And so by doing that, it enables the family or whoever's renting it, they see a real value in staying there rather than if they're paying $1,700 and they're struggling and then they just say, hey, you know, this is too much, I'm going to leave, after they've punched holes in the drywall and everything, and now you got to come back in there and fix it up. So by offering it, by intentionally offering it at the lower rate, you wind up with a better relationship with the people who are in your property.
Absolutely.
Wow.
And yeah, you're absolutely right, my brother.
Okay. So now you've got these properties. They are generating income to you and your wife, and actually to your entire family, and I take it that you all have wills, so that you've directed how you want this wealth to be passed down to the grandchildren.
Yes, and actually I have a stepson that's Asperger. But he's very high functioning, and he lives independently. He comes and be with us on the weekends, but we have a special trust in place for him. And of course, the way that we have things set up is he will benefit from at least two properties that we have. However, you know, he will not be selling the properties, but he would benefit in terms of the income producing. And so with that being that he would never marry under those circumstances, whatever he has in his ownership will automatically go to the two granddaughters, which are 16 years old right now.
Wow. That's fantastic. So let me jump here and say two points right here, Brother L.A. Number one, the overall work of Us Lifting Us, as many of us realize, we are building the economic infrastructure of an alternative economy, global economy, for people of African descent. In other words, we are pooling our dollars and cents to open cooperative businesses that are collectively owned by all of us, and we then can do a couple of things. We can take some of that surplus and put it back into the business to expand our capacity to open more businesses. We can use part of that surplus as a way of underwriting African-centered schools, African-centered health facilities, senior citizens' homes. So we have resources for those kinds of things. And the remainder goes back to co-op unit holders in the form of a dividend. So, but that process takes time. The thing that I found so exciting about what you and your family were doing was these are some practical steps that each of us can do right now, even as we work collectively to build Us Lifting Us. Every family can examine whether or not this is a program that would work for them, and it helps us to gain, if you will, financial, what's the word I'm looking for? We just become more knowledgeable of how to use these financial tools that are all around us and other people are using. And we, for whatever reason, maybe out of fear, out of not knowing, just not have made those moves. So I think what your family has done is provided a model that other families can replicate if they choose to do so. I know after I heard you talk about this, I said I was going to share this with my own family and see, you know, whether or not we can make this work. But it's a strategy. It's an additional strategy as all of us gain financial skills and become more adept at managing all of the resources that flow through our hands, because we say frequently on this program that $1.3 trillion flows through Black fingers annually. And you know, most of us say, well, you know, $1.3 trillion, what is that? And we say, you know, if someone gave you $1 million right now, and then an hour from now gave you another million, and then an hour from then gave you another million, and they did that around the clock, all day, all week, all month, all year, it would take 114 years to get to $1.3 trillion. So there's a lot of money sloshing around in our community in different ways, and you have tapped upon a way to do something as basic as an insurance policy as a way of finding additional resources to do something as basic and as important as buying a home or buying real estate that can be leveraged into either rental property or property for, you know, for your family to live in. And then the real genius is you've done it with your family in such a way that they understand that this is something that can be passed down to each generation of your children. And that's so consistent with the Ulu values of Ma'at and the Nguza Saba. I mean, all of it comes to bear in this model that you and your family have done. So am I summarizing that accurately, Brother L.A.?
Oh, you are. You're spot on. It is actually what we're able to do. Like I said, we started off not necessarily knowing that this was the direction that things were going to flow in, but when the opportunity presented itself, and I believe when you look at the housing market right now, it is unstable right now. I think at some point, I'm not sure in, you know, our lifetime, but possibly that, you know, this same opportunity is going to present itself again. You know, and the beautiful thing about didn't initiate it, the grandparents can do it as well. you know. And it's so much more of a gift to give to a child than the many things that we spend our money on that bring no value to them whatsoever in terms of...
You mean all the money we get ready to spend on the holidays, the Christmas, all that stuff we're going to buy?
Absolutely. You know, and what greater gift can you give a grandchild, you know, than a life insurance policy if it's not in place by the parents? So
that's
the opportunity is there. But we have to change our mindset about what life insurance really are all about, you know. Once we can change our thinking, you know, and start thinking like we have to be able to function in this capitalistic society that we live in, you know, those are the rules. We didn't make them, but we have to coexist in them because this is where we are. And so, you know, all I'm saying is this is just one strategy, you know, and then there's other little nuggets that go along with everything that me and my wife does. Case in point, you know, we don't other than a house and a car, you know. What big ticket items, whatever it might be, you know, we're not going to allow interest rates on credit cards and all those things to overwhelm us. Now, I've been there and did that when I was a younger person, but I've learned better. And therefore, you know, a lot of this came because of bumps in the road. I mean, I was one who was a victim of the adjustable rate mortgage on the first house I bought. And I ended up having to walk away from it because it ballooned beyond my ability to pay for it. And that was years ago.
What was the mortgage rate when you got it? What did you get into it at, and what did it balloon to?
I think I was about 5 or 6% when I bought it, and it went up to about 14 or 15 interest percent after about 5 years. Yeah.
So it doubled.
It
doubled at least, probably more than doubled.
Yeah, it more than doubled. You know, and you know, and the whole concept behind that was your income will, you know, in the later years as you get, you know, as you're still in that job, it's supposed, your income supposed to rise, but it never rises to the degree inflation, you know, in those interest rates with those adjustable
rate
mortgages. Yeah, and so I had to, you know, walk away from that situation, you know, because I just couldn't afford it, you know. And so I've experienced the, you know, the good and the bad, you know, and the good feel a lot better, but it's based on a whole lot more, you know, discipline and like delayed gratification, you know, and that's something that we have a difficult time sometimes dealing with. You know, it's so easy to pull out a credit card and buy what you want, but, you know, you're going to have to pay the piper sooner or later.
Yeah, and you have to be very mindful of what the interest rate is. I mean, if you got a credit card and that interest rate is north of, you know, almost 19%, 20%, something like that,
yeah,
that's really not a credit card. You know, that's a...
Right.
That's
and like, as long as you can use it and pay it off in 30 days, then there's no harm, no foul in that. But if you have to, you know, carry it over a period of time, it can be very detrimental to your financial well-being.
Absolutely. Sister Q, did you want to jump in and ask any questions or make any observations on this information that's being shared tonight?
Yes, I do. Thank you. Brother L.A., recently I saw an article stating that some of the banks were now getting ready to basically do what they did in 2007, which is offer houses to, the way they described it, is black and brown people with no qualifications, basically, you know, like just come and get a house, whether you can afford it or not. We're not going to ask you for these kinds of, you know, make sure that you can pay for the house. So it sounded basically like they were trying to set up, again, the same kind of thing where all these people would go out and get houses that they can't afford, and then the rug would be pulled out from under them. Based on what you have said, how can we use that setup in a strategic way so that we can not only buy these houses at low cost without too much fanfare, but then use that to create, to our advantage, to create a wealth situation? Do you see that being a possibility?
Yeah, I think if personally at this point I would not buy any type of real estate because it's overpriced, and I think that purchasing and looking, because you're absolutely right. I believe, I sense that the housing market is going to present itself very much similar the way it did in 2007. And so I think it should be prepared. If they have a few dollars, be prepared to take advantage of the opportunity situation, because I do see history repeat itself. Because what has happened is you have a lot of these capital venture corporations that have bought property in bulk. Hundreds of times, they bought entire subdivisions, and you can't even buy a house in the subdivision because you have to rent from them.
Right.
So that's the latest strategy they use in the housing market, and I'm saying that at some point they're not going to do well upkeeping these houses. Because like I said, when folks can't afford to stay on a property, you know, every 12 months when that lease is up and people are bailing out, it takes thousands of dollars to get their house back up to specifications. And I can see that being a problem for a landlord that isn't even local, you know, because a lot of these folks, a lot of these capital venture corporations, they're in California, different places, but they've bought all the houses up in Florida, Georgia, wherever they might be. They bought these subdivisions. And I can see that becoming a real problem as far as the upkeep of these properties.
Mm-hmm. You know, I was going to say, where in the city where I live, there have been a couple of developments that I have seen that the whole development is for rent. You can't even buy a house in the development. And it's new housing. They're building new houses, but they're for rent only.
Right.
So I see what you're saying.
Yeah, that's where the problem lies. But I believe that's going to – you know, they're all about making quick money. So if they can get in and flip it and make their money and go on down the road, that's what they're going to do. But I'm saying I believe the option for individuals who are prepared to step in and make those purchases when the time comes. And I see it being a problem, especially when it comes to property upkeep.
Mm-hmm.
It's just not going to
You know that I need to jump in and say this also. Ulu has a sub. What would you call it? We have another cooperative called Fauna Properties that is a real estate purchasing arm for us. So we will be talking with the Finance Research and Development Committee of Ulu to see if Fauna Properties can facilitate us acquiring properties that can be used for rental situations. So I think to Brother LA's point and to Sister Q to your question, we know that capitalism by nature is cyclical. So what happened in 2007 will certainly happen again. It's just a question of when. 15 years, there'll be another housing bust, and the prices will crash, and the vultures will sweep in and gobble up those distressed properties again for pennies on the dollar. And if we're prepared, we should be in a position where strategically we can pick up a few of those properties at a good price and do some positive things with them. So this is all increasing our financial literacy so that we are more savvy as we move through the environment. As Brother LA pointed out, this is a system, it's not designed for us. It's quite the opposite. It's designed to exploit us, but if we understand it better, there are ways that we can make it work for our benefit. And so this model that Brother L.A. has shared certainly gives us a lot of room to explore and to better understand, because there are opportunities there. And I think what resonated with me the most was the fact that he and his wife were able to do this on very modest incomes. You know, we're not surprised when people who are making six figures, both parties are making six figures when they make real estate moves. I mean, they've got the surplus income to do that. But when people who are making $40,000 each are able to make a move like this and wind up with six properties in excess of $1.5 million, that gets everybody's attention. You know, black folks ain't supposed to do it.
I would say so.
But, you know, we always find a way to you know, take the lemons and make lemonade. And so as Brother LA says, this is a strategy that some of us can take advantage of.
Let me just say one thing before we leave. I just want to stress that we're talking about, like you say, whole life insurance purchases because they have cash value. Any policy that have, they call it different names, but we're talking about whole life insurance with cash value, because I was telling Brother Ante earlier, I've outlived so many term insurance policies until it's unbelievable, you know, and that doesn't benefit anybody, you know. So the whole key is to provide policies that you want outlive, because term insurance, it may be cheap, but the odds are against you in terms of benefiting from it. And it doesn't provide cash value.
You know, A.L. Williams used to make the argument that, and Primerica was A.L. Williams before it became Primerica, they were arguing, you know, the best way to do insurance is buy a term and invest the difference. But
right.
A lot of black folks
never did
the investment part. And so they had a 20-year term policy that was cheap. But like you say, the policy expired, and they didn't have the investments to replace the face value of the policy. So that didn't work.
I was a part of that A.L. Williams. That's when I first got my insurance license with A.L. Williams. So, yeah, that buy term and invest the difference. Yeah, right.
Did you have anybody that was successful in doing that, Brother L.A.?
No. However, I still have two Prime American policies because the policies I did have had my children on as riders, and when they turned 18, I had to convert I could no longer have the rider, so I had to convert it to an actual term policy because that's all they would offer. But no, I don't know of anybody who was successful in that projection with ELW. Mm-hmm. It sounded good, you know,
mm-hmm.
but like discipline just not there for a lot of people.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. So in anything you would, in as we begin to wrap up, Brother L.A., I'm just looking at the time. Any closing thoughts about what we've talked about tonight?
Again, I think the point is being made is it doesn't take a lot of money to do this. It just takes a lot of discipline to do it, you know, a lot of financial discipline.
Well, you know that you make an excellent point, and life requires discipline. So it's something that we just have to do. I think it's a brother, the psychologist out of Florida, Akbar, makes the point that what separates children, the adolescents from the adults, is discipline. So if you know when we're fully grown and mature, the hallmark of that maturation is we've developed the discipline to manage our environment. And to navigate it more effectively. So thank you for that information and for coming on and giving us some exciting ideas to work with, Brother L.A. Sister Q, it's back on you, dear.
Okay. Thank you, Brother L.A., for sharing the information that you shared with us tonight. Thank you, Brother Ansi, for bringing Brother L.A. forward to us. We want to thank everyone who joined us this evening, the listening audience, and we would like to invite you to join us again next Thursday evening at 9:00 Eastern Time for another installment of Dare to Win. Peace.
Peace.
Peace. Thanks, Brother L.A. Talk to you soon.
Thank you.